are blaming each other.
The UN Security Council's called for a thorough and independent international investigation. David Cameron says those responsible must be brought to account.
It is an absolutely appalling, shocking, horrific incident.
Prince William spoken of his deep sadness.
Words cannot do justice to our sense of loss.
European observers have now arrived at the scene of the crash. They say they'll be doing anything they can to offer dignity in death to the victims. In other news, a coroner's cleared an expedition company of neglect after 17-year-old schoolboy Horatio Chapo was mauled to death by a polar bear in 2011. The narrative verdict at the inquests concluded that although the group was missing some equipment, the society hadn't acted with neglect. A report into allegations of extremism in Birmingham schools has found some staff were promoting Islamic principles while council bosses failed to address the problem. The report by the City Council says there was a coordinated plan to impose hardline Islamic practices in 13 schools. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Your difference is our strength on Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. Yes, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Daniela Radici, councillor for Bishopston, a Green councillor indeed. And leader of the Green Party, I just found out. Green Group. And Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, losing one Malaysian airliner, two, might be considered carelessness. Is it just coincidence a second passenger load of people on this little Islamic country's national airline have met their doom? And what real evidence is there about who shot this plane down, who had what to gain? Former MI5 officer Annie Machon explains how, under former Defence Secretary Malcolm Rifkind and the Tory government, there's no real oversight at all of our intelligence services, and they can do pretty much what they want. Plus, tomorrow's march in Bristol city centre in support of the people of Palestine. Although the US was the first country to recognise the state of Israel, Palestine conflict was arguably a problem Britain created way back in 1947. The Israelis call it mowing the grass, every few years going into Gaza and the West Bank to trim down the population. It's horrifying, but we're going to be talking about it after the 6 o'clock news. Also, journalist Dan Glazebrook was in town this week, and I spoke to him about his new book, Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in a Name of Crisis. And Martin will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, well, it's staying sticky, isn't it? Lows of 16 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 24 Celsius, thunderstorms and some very heavy downfalls over the weekend. Next week, highs of 27 Celsius, sunny for most of the week, with potential further thunderstorms and showers. Next weekend, that's the 26th and the 27th of July, highs of 24 and sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the Weather Outlook. So helping us review this week's news is not the leader of the Green Party, but the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council. That's Daniela Radici. Hi, Daniela, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon.
Now, first of all, the Mayor, because we're having George Ferguson on here next week, we hope, if he manages to come to the right radio station. He didn't last time. But I just wonder what your thoughts are about how things are going with the Mayor. I've been talking to Mark Weston last week and also to Gary Hopkins the previous week about how this is going. We've had a couple of years of this. Is it working or not?
It's certainly raised the level of interest in politics in Bristol, I think. It's had an impact that people really know there's politics going on. I think it has had a positive effect in some ways. He's taken some unpopular decisions, and there have been vast changes, but with the absolute background of all the austerity measures. And what's interesting to me is it's that eternal debate between how much power the officers of the council have and how much power the mayor has. And the mayor has a reasonable overview, but the real problem with it is that he's just one person. And he has taken, as he says, the responsibility for the decisions, but he's only one person, and there's no way one person can solve everything in a city. So I think he's doing the best he can, but I still think it's a flawed system.
Well, it's impossible for one person to do it all. Surely, I mean, it's within his power. We'll be talking to him about this next week, delegate. Is he doing that enough?
He delegates, and he has cabinet members, but he has not delegated decision-making authority to those cabinet advisers. So that would be something he'd do, and I think that would be a positive step. Obviously, he sees danger in it politically because he wants to take credit for everything that goes right. But I think it would actually make for a better, more efficient and probably more effective decision-making system.
Not anyone that doesn't delegate in that position as much as they ought to. You start thinking of them as a bit of a control freak. Is that going too far?
It could be. I don't think he's by nature a control freak, but I think he just likes to feel that he's the centre of everything and the buck will stop with him. And I think you really need to be able to say some things can't be done by one person. He can't have those insights. But the problem is also that all the attention is being focused. I get loads of emails from constituents that they copy the mayor in. But obviously he hasn't got the time or effort to reply to them all. And that actually leads to more frustration with people. So people are getting involved, copying him in, and then being more frustrated that he can't help them. Mm. So it's also causing those sort of problems.
Well, that is. I mean, and also, I mean, you know, 500,000 people or so, not just in Bristol, but in the surrounding region, you know, with South Gloucestershire, etc. I mean, you've got a lot of people to satisfy there. Again, I come back to this whole thing of delegating responsibility. Surely he can employ a couple of staff to answer those emails. The worst thing in the world is if people just don't get any reply at all and they feel they're not being listened to. Yeah. There's not even the sense they're being listened to. Mm.
He has got, obviously, staff, but with the massive austerity cuts, you know, the council's made hundreds of people, well, taken voluntary severance or made redundant. So there is really not a huge capacity in staff doing anything in the council. I think we're feeling that right across the different services. One thing we're particularly concerned about is all the cycle schemes that money's been applied for and grants have been given, but they haven't got the staff to actually implement them.
So the money's there, but nothing's happening?
Yeah. Or we thought they were going ahead and we find out they're not, because actually the staff... They've narrowed the staff down far too much to deliver what they actually want to.
But I mean, isn't this a bit of curmudgeonliness from the council officers? Sometimes they make things more difficult because then that draws attention to the fact that so many have been sacked.
Could be, but I think when you go from, say, a team of 20 down to a team, or say maybe 12 down to a team of 2, I don't think you can blame the people for not getting on with the work.
Okay, there's this no confidence petition which has been worked up, and that's mainly around against the mayor, and this is mainly around the residents' parking. And I imagine it's the well-organised Cliftonites that have got this together. I'm not sure. I'm actually only guessing on that one. How does this all work? Because if you get up to, I think it's over 3,500 signatures, that will cause a debate in the council chamber. Yeah. Now, this is an important, and really important idea, isn't it? A motion of no confidence. If this is happening up at Westminster, that could mean a general election if a prime minister loses a vote of no confidence, or certainly a change of party leader. Most times in the past, it's one of those kind of knife edge motions. In Bristol, it's not the same, though, is it? Yeah. Why not?
In effect, because it's a petition that's come from outside the council and it's reached a number of signatures, all it means is that there is going to be a debate. So it means it's an issue in the city and the councils will debate it. But there is no mechanism for that to become a motion under the current constitution of the council.
I mean, can't you, as a councillor, just write it as a motion?
No, the motions have to be agreed in advance. If you look at the agenda, we've put several motions in because there's a cycling petition, which we think is really important to debate about the future of cycling and getting good cycling
network. Well, I've noticed more and more people in the city are cycling. Yeah. It's becoming almost like Oxford up Gloucester Road.
It can be a bit scary in a huge peloton of cyclists.
Yeah, but it's great to see.
It is great. But so we've also got a motion on the agenda put by Councillor Charlie Bolton to say, let's actually implement what the petition is asking for. But under the constitution, we can't get that petition, that motion debated, even though there's going to be a debate on the petition.
Hang on. Democracy? So you can't get it debated even?
No, because the golden motion this time is Labour's, and they've chosen a different motion to be their favourite one of the month, which is incidentally one that we already got passed before council 2 years ago.
I do wonder if you sometimes feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall.
Yes, it can feel like that. I mean, it's a matter of a drip, drip, drip of influence, I think.
I mean, how does this sort of thing happen? Is it just because the constitutional system we're working with the mayor and the council is imposed on us? Or is it because, there's so much party rivalry that parties don't want to get together to change things?
I think parties, if there was an issue, I mean, you saw back when there was a previous residents' parking debate and motion, there was actually a motion. The whole council voted unanimously that the mayor had to go back and look at it again. As a result, there was a residents' parking working group. It was actually a very positive group I was on it, which actually looked at some of the detailed issues and thrashed them out and made recommendations for the future. So that can happen. But I think, it's a difficult situation and we're not really helped. But the fact is that even when we had a cabinet system, say when the Lib Dems were in power, your average councillor was in exactly the same position as we are in now. It's just that all the councillors are in that position now rather than being a group that supports the cabinet and the opposition.
Well, there is the other possibility of that. That is, of course, that most of the councillors actually do support George and what he's doing. So, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know you're ferociously anti the idea of a mayor in the first place, but we've got to work with the system, haven't we?
Well, that's right. I mean, we're stuck with it for the duration. I think that the problems we're getting are built into the system. There's too much power in the hands of one person, and fundamentally the real issue is we've got to make £80-90 million worth of cuts, and nobody really wants to do that, and it's an extremely unpleasant process.
Do you think, Danielle, do you think George has been batting for Bristol up at Westminster, Downing Street, as of course we were promised before he was elected he would do?
I think he's been trying, but in effect the government has, to use an unpolite term, shafted lots of local authorities. I was at the LGA conference last week.
That's the Local Government Association conference.
Yeah. And there were a lot of angry local government people from across the political spectrum, Conservative leaders included, just completely frustrated with the government. They'd been promised powers, all sorts of powers. They had schemes. They'd been told you can have independence, you can do what you like. They said, right, they said, no, you've got to include Essex with Kent because we want you to. So that doesn't make sense. So it's just part of a whole kind of, what do you call it, devolution wash, I think, that's been applied
so they're saying
the
we're going to devolve power. Actually, what they're doing is there's more central control.
Completely.
From Westminster. And I suppose this is all, Martin, isn't it, down to this whole who pays the piper calls the tune, because so much of the money the local authority is spending here is coming from Westminster too, isn't it?
It is, and the standard spending assessments have been blatantly rigged so that inner city Liverpool lost more, and the East Dorset, which is the most prosperous part of Britain, slightly gained. So it's not, and Bristol's in the middle of that, and that's really determines what local authorities have got to spend, and the council tax really is neither here nor there.
I think local authorities across the country and the Local Government Association have actually come up with quite a good manifesto for local government, talking about a lot more devolution of power, spending, raising, because they pointed out, 50 to 100 years ago, everything was done by the local authority, and there wasn't much actually under the control of Westminster, and it's all been, there were the fire and the police and all those sort of services, even the NHS were locally controlled.
But there seems to be a control freakery abroad in Britain today. And I mean, we had, for example, Paul Forrest, the coroner, who was sacked a few years ago. His office is supposed to be independent, but actually instrumental in getting him removed was the city council. Now, as far as I'm concerned, an independent coroner should be an independent coroner. They shouldn't be using the fact that his pay comes through the city council in order to sack him, which is effectively what seems to have happened. Mentioned briefly the residents' park. But there's been a raft of changes made to Clifton residents. I mean, the Clifton, I suppose it was bound to happen first, wasn't it? It's like, if we can get it right in Clifton, maybe we can get it right elsewhere. The residents' parking zone campaigners, they drove a tank through the streets of Clifton, didn't they? An old Sherman tank. Yeah. More than 100 changes have been made to a planned residents' parking zone in Clifton. This is in the Post this week, which is set to come into force in October. Among the biggest changes is to the City Council's Clifton Village Zone is 3 hours max. Maximum pay and display in the area south of Clifton Park where the shops are. Changes come after a long-ranging campaign which saw a tank again. Previously there was only going to be a maximum of 1 or 2 hour parking. Well, it's sort of tweaking, Daniela, but do you think this is going to be, what happens in Clifton is going to be a model rolled out across the rest of the city?
Well, that's one of the things that the working group that I was on emphasised, that actually each area of the city needs to have attention paid to its own needs. For example, my ward, which includes some of Gloucester Road, if we ever get residents parking up there, there's going to be needs for the shops, the businesses there that are going to be have to take into account. And that's what we've said, actually, it can't be a one-size-fits-all policy. I think there has been a lot of changes within Clifton, which is good, and there are a lot of people in favour of residents parking in Clifton. And I think one of the things that happens with this debate is that the no campaign is very aggressive. I've been to meetings where there's been a lot of vociferous opposition, and then afterwards people might come up to you quietly and say, actually, I'm in favour. But they felt intimidated and scared of speaking up in favour because of the anger emotion that the negative people have come up with. So it's one of those interesting things. Also in my ward, I got quite a few people saying against it, and then afterwards people said to me, oh well, actually I wanted it, but they never said they wanted it because they thought it was going ahead. So it's perhaps the way it's coming out is not quite reflecting true public opinion.
Just one thing that the Post seem to have missed out here, perish the thought, but they do seem to have missed it, is actually how much it's going to cost. There are all sorts of little bits and pieces, yeah. But how much are these tickets going to cost? And maybe that's one of the reasons this has been introduced in Clifton first, because they know the Cliftonites can afford to pay for it.
Yeah, well, actually, the way the scheme's been organised is that the amount they get from parking fees hasn't been factored into paying back the cost of the scheme. The cost of the scheme is coming from the permits, and they factored in an 8 to 12 year payback period based on the number of permits they're going to issue in the area. So the actual income and fines has not been factored into that costing at all.
So do you know how much it's going to cost every resident per year?
A permit is about £50 a year. For your first car, and then there's a sliding scale for your second. You can have up to 3 cars per household.
Interesting, isn't it? And this, oh, I think I was just, the penny has just dropped over here, by the way. If, do it in Clifton, they can afford it. Martin?
Well, I mean, these obviously, it's better if things are negotiated with local people. And something has to be done about transport in Bristol, but it's always going to be controversial, isn't it?
Okay, on to another story this week, a new Snowden docs. This is The Guardian's little... The Guardian did do an interview with Edward Snowden this week, I believe, but this is actually something which Glenn Greenwald from Brazil published at the beginning of the week, and what the new Snowden docs are saying is that British spies are actually seeding the internet with loads of false information. And actually one of the most worrying things is they're manipulating online, I mean there's lots and lots of worrying stuff in here, manipulating online polls, increasing traffic to websites, amplifying messages, making sure they go much further than they would otherwise go, denial of service attacks against websites, basically taking websites down, spoofing email addresses. I hope they don't spoof my email address. I'd be rather annoyed if they did. But Martin, actually, out of this list, probably the most worrying is when people are doing some kind of online election, online poll, GCHQ are in there, they press a button and loads of little robots start voting away.
Well, yes, I mean, what we were led to believe, these people are listening to try and find bad behaviour and illegal activity. But actually it transpires that they're spending their days manipulating online polls, seeding disinformation. I mean, this is what people don't realise about intelligence services. The intelligence services don't spend most of their time collecting information. They spend most of their time spinning disinformation. And that, of course, is taxpayers' money being used to bamboozle taxpayers. Totally unacceptable.
But how will we do anything about that? I mean, that's just basically what they do. So how are you going to change?
We now know what they do.
Change things?
I would argue that it's completely illegal for a government-backed organisation using taxpayer money to fiddle with online polls in order to get results that they would like to see. That's taxpayers' money being used to bamboozle taxpayers.
I suppose they've only managed to get away with it, Daniela, because of this sort of big wall of secrecy. You know, the 3 barbed wire fences down at Cheltenham, you know, you can't get through.
No.
But what they're doing inside, you know, it does sound to me as if it's all of our worst fears, really.
Well, I feel it's possibly also a huge waste of taxpayers' money, because we all know that if you can easily fiddle a poll, it's not worth the paper, the screen that it's printed on. You know, that there are various online polls all over the place done by marketing firms, companies. We know Facebook recently manipulated its whole data for a month to prove that if you make, you know, send lots of happy kittens, people feel happy, and, you know, dead kittens, people feel sad. But so I think it's just a waste of time to be trying to do these things and manipulate opinion, because the internet is so big and so diverse that I can't see what actual tangible benefit it would give to anyone.
Yeah, so what's the point of it all, Martin? It sounds like millions and millions of our money being spent on something which is utterly pointless.
Well, I would agree that a lot of it probably is time-wasting and pointless, but then some of it is rather important. when you can actually steer public opinion in a certain direction in the middle of a crisis, for example, over Ukraine or Palestine or whatever. And that, of course, I would argue that there's probably a reason to have the intelligence services, but they should not be interfering with the political process. They shouldn't be interfering with it at all.
Daniela, how are we going to reform them? Because we keep hearing time and time again, it's the former Defence Secretary, Conservative Defence Secretary Sir Malcolm Rifkin, who's overseeing it, and yet he has his own little consultancy. I can't remember the name of the company, Lex Consulting, I think it's called. He actually works for the defence industry, and yet he's there as a parliamentary representative to supposedly oversee it, where alongside him are such tough nuts as Hazel Blears and various other people who you really don't get the sense that their heart is in it for the public. They seem to be much more interested in get sort of cozying up to the defence industry, having nice lunches maybe out with them, tours around to defence sites or whatever, but they don't really seem to be fighting our corner.
Yeah, I think this is a real issue for politicians all over the place. We need proper accountability, but we also need to have a situation where politicians do not get sucked into the system, because by nature they start interacting with it and start, you know, making human relationships with the people that they're supposed to be holding to account. And that almost doesn't work, does it? Because it's very hard to do that. And so I think we need to pay attention to the processes by which people do that and say, actually, are you asking the right questions? Do we know if you're asking the right questions? And can we have a bit of transparency and public information about what you're asking the security services to do or not do?
And I would say exactly the same about defence journalists. They probably go exactly just as easily sucked in. Martin, we were talking to Ian Fraser, the financial journalist, recently, weren't we? And he was saying how so many of the financial journalists are basically just part of the city.
Well, I'm afraid that's a problem of journalism in general. But I think the security services in particular are way out of control. I mean, for example, the Snoopers Charter. It transpires, what it looks like to me, is they came forward with...
Sorry, that's this this law that was passed as an emergency law earlier in the week.
But the fact of the matter is, when it was brought up, the similar measures were suggested by the coalition not long ago. It seems to me that GCHQ have been doing all these things all along, and what they're asking for is retrospective...
Well, that is what they say here.
...retrospective justification for what they've been doing. Mm. So what else are they doing that we don't know about? Yeah. I mean, they've been saying for years that they weren't doing these things, and it transpires that they are. How are we to believe them? We're not to believe them.
Well, I suppose I'm reminded a little bit of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Daniela, what are your thoughts about how to reform it? Anyway, we know there's a problem. How are we going to change things?
It can only be the fact that you need more democratic transparency and openness about what they're actually doing, and there need to be maybe some kind... I think you need politicians to be involved, because there's got to be that... If you start trying to appoint an independent person, I don't think you can ever rely on the fact they'd be independent. You need somebody who's got the possibility of being removed from office in a democratic process. But we also need to have a sort of unveiling of what actually goes on, what the parameters are. Who's actually calling the tune here? Are the politicians telling them what to do? Or are they setting the agenda?
Well, in theory, Sir Malcolm Rifkin surely could be removed, as he's an MP.
Yes.
You know, his constituency, the only thing, of course, he's in a super safe seat, so it's very unlikely.
Yes, that comes back to reform of the political system, doesn't it? And having a proportional system, and also something that actually relates back to our debate on George earlier, which is a system of recall, which we advocate very strongly. I know there's a proposal going forward on that, but we don't think it's actually as good as it should be, that you can actually vote in the middle of a term for a politician to be got rid of. I mean, even with the security services, they were put our own Jenny Jones and Caroline Lucas on their list of domestic extremists, and these were democratic.
I thought you were going to say on their committee that was going to oversee them, but no,
unfortunately not. That would have been helpful.
Well, I suppose that would mean if they're domestic extremists, they'd be vetted and they would never be allowed to be on the committee. How very convenient. Anyway, let's have a look at some of the other news and go to Parliament now and Westminster Prime Minister's questions, because there was a big old reshuffle this week. We're going to hear from Jonathan Reynolds. One of the questions he asked was about the number of women who have been introduced into the cabinet, because this is a bit of an issue, because so many women have been sacked. So everyone was hoping that we were going to get roughly towards the 50-50 gender balance, but oh no, Jonathan Reynolds asked the question.
Mr. Jonathan Reynolds, can the Prime Minister explain why he's now given more knighthoods to men than he sacked? That he's given cabinet jobs to women.
Yeah. All women. Always interesting to take a lecture from a party that gave a knighthood to Fred Goodwin. That is always a good
a good place to start. I have appointed more women to the front bench, more women to our cabinet, on the basis that they deserve those jobs, and I want a team that reflects modern Britain and can be everything that modern Britain needs it to be. I make no apology for saying I think in public life we should recognise public service, people who have worked hard, people who contributed to our nation, contributed to our government. I think that is a good thing to do.
Well, I think that's too little too late from our lovely Prime Minister. He's appointed some women into the Cabinet, but he's actually had, how many, 4 years to do that? And now, just a year before the general election, he said, oh look, I've suddenly realised there aren't enough women around. People have been pointing this out for years and years. And it does feel a bit like tokenism, actually. I mean, it's a real problem that there aren't enough women in politics, but it feels worse almost to say that, oh, we're just going to win an election, now we get the women in. And what chance are those women going to have to influence policy? Because there's not that much going on now for the next year.
Well, the rate of attrition so far, Martin, with women being kicked out of the cabinet, is pretty strong. Do you think there'll be any left by the time of the election next year?
Well, I think there probably will be. What was very interesting was the woman who was made... took to Gove's job, I've forgotten the name of it. She's a woman, also, she's still Minister for Equalities, but she's not giving up the equalities role, she's taking over running schools as well.
Yeah, so that's typical. You get a woman and you get her to do double the amount of work as any man.
Also, in the House of Lords, they've been really annoyed about what's happening, because although there is a female leader of the House of Lords that's going to be a member of the Cabinet, she's also been downgraded. She's not going to be paid anywhere near as much. She's going to have a lesser role. And amazingly enough, her salary is going to be being paid by the Conservative Party, not by the government. Oh, sorry, not by the whatever they are, I suppose, the civil service, by the Tory party. Amazing. And here's a little clip now from today in Parliament. We're going to hear first from one of the Lords, Cormac, Lord Cormac, who's a Conservative, and Lord Royal, who's Labour. And then this is all about Lady Stowell, who's going into the Cabinet from being Leader of the House of Lords, but she's going to be also demoted at the same time.
What is at stake here is not the status of my noble friend, but the status of this House.
Yeah. I was deeply dismayed that the Prime Minister could treat this House with such contempt. What are the precedents for a political party paying part of a Cabinet Minister's salary?
Yeah, yeah.
And, my Lords, given the fact that the Leader is Leader of the whole House and not just of the Conservative bench, surely this is both improper and unethical.
Well, improper and unethical. I think that was sums it up, really. I mean, why is the government being having people in the government paid by the Conservative Party? Quite extraordinary.
What they're saying is they're going to basically top up her salary because the salary wouldn't have been enough. But surely, I mean, that, at least they're doing that. They're making sure that she's not taking a drop in pay.
Well, yes, I mean, I've only just heard this, so it's hard to make a serious comment about it. But, I mean, a lot of this is window dressing for the election. I see the hand of Linton Crosby, the mad digger behind all of this.
OK, Daniela, what about your comments about what's happened with Lady Stowell? Because the point that's made there by Lady Royal in the House of Lords is, well, hang on a minute, how can the Conservative Party be paying for a government minister who's actually the leader of all parties in the House of Lords? Yeah. It just seems a little bit like they're trying to kind of shift the goalposts.
This does raise huge questions about that. Why should the Conservative Party be paying the salary of any minister? Have they done this before? What's the precedent? Why are they allowed to do it? I mean, it's typical that they give a woman a job and then say she can't have the full salary and sit at the same table. And, I mean, that goes on day in, day out in companies, offices, organisations across the country. I know lots of women doing jobs for much less money than a man would be paid for. Just
in fact,
because
that gap is getting wider, apparently.
Exactly.
As well.
Yeah. So, especially with the recession, people, you know, hang on to their jobs and don't ask for pay rises or don't get
them. But why should women be suffering in that situation more than men? It just shows us some sort of inbuilt prejudice.
There is definitely a deep inbuilt prejudice and cultural problem about women and women being perceived as, because a lot of characteristics of leadership are also naturally perceived as being male, and it's very difficult to decouple those, and it's quite a tricky issue in general. But we need to change the culture, and there's a lot of work going on. In Bristol, we're going to have a campaign for 50-50 women councillors by 2016, so we haven't got very far with it yet, but keep an eye out.
Okay, ladies out there, if you feel strongly about politics, step up to the plate.
Yep. Whatever party.
Now we go to Jack Straw, who also asked a question about the reshuffle, this time about the removal of Dominic Grieve, Attorney General.
Jack Straw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is fundamental, is it not, that the holder of the office of Attorney General should be fearlessly independent, defend the rule of law, and be ready to speak legal truth to power.
Yeah.
Given the distinction and respect with which the holder of that office pursued that role, what possessed the Prime Minister to dismiss him yesterday?
Well, first of all, can I say I absolutely agree with the Right Honourable Gentleman that it's vitally important that the Attorney General gives unvarnished, independent advice and is the government's legal adviser. But I also believe in government, when someone has served extremely well for 4 years, there are often times when it's right to bring on new talent and to make the most of all the talent you have in your party. That is the approach I take as Prime Minister, and I explain that very clearly to my team.
Well, I'm not really sure what the political implications of this all are.
Well, I mean, the guy that's replaced him, I'm not sure, I haven't got his name to hand, but he's a Eurosceptic. In fact, there's quite a lot have been brought in, whereas Dominic Grieve wasn't. He was trying to have a constructive dialogue with the European Court over all sorts of issues.
In other words, he's taken a lurch to the right. Whether it'll do him any good electorally, we will see.
Daniela, is it possible, do you think, to maintain a really independent Attorney General who can speak truth to power, even when it's the Prime Minister?
I don't know. It should be, shouldn't it? I mean, in theory, it can be, but especially when he's just got rid of one and had a more politically convenient one in place, who doesn't really. And I think the problem is with these Eurosceptic people, they don't understand how to get what they want out of Europe because they're just so blinded with their sort of anti-Europe prejudice. And actually what you need is people who understand what they're faced with rather than just coming at it. And I think Cameron's faced that problem all along. He's just sort of gone in like a angry little, I don't know, well, no, can't think of the right word. And just everyone just sort of looks down and says, well, no, because you're not speaking to us in the right language, not understanding where we're coming from.
But isn't there some sort of inbuilt contradiction here? You've got Parliament making laws and you've got European Parliament making laws. One tries to make a law to go against the law that another's made, and there's just this massive, it's great money for the lawyers, of course, sorting it all out. But, you know, there has to be some kind of decision, surely, about which court has precedence. In law, apparently, it's the European Court, but that seems to be what Dominic Grieve has been trying to slowly implement.
The European Court of Human Rights has nothing to do with the European Union. It's actually a separate structure set up at the end of World War II to create a baseline for European countries in terms of human rights law. So it's nothing to do with the EU at all. But I bet you loads of Tory Eurosceptics don't even know that.
It doesn't sound like the reshuffled cabinet and what wants much to do with it. Anyway, we're going to go now to a longer clip. And this is because I was very frustrated to see that Ian Duncan Smith, probably one of the most dangerous politicians in terms of human health we've had in this country for a long, long time, was just kept in place. In denial Smith is what I like to call him, IDS. And Glenda Jackson, a little while ago, I thought it was an excellent speech about him. So because IDS managed to go completely under the radar at the reshuffle, we're going to hear now from Glenda Jackson and her views as a Labour MP about the way that Ian Duncan Smith's changes to the welfare system in this country have impacted her constituents.
Glenda Jackson.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, I think the Honourable Gentleman will in the future regret taking such pride in his Secretary of State. We have all become used to the Secretary of State avoiding answering any kind of direct question or actively engaging in any of the serious issues which have to do with the destruction of the welfare state and the total and utter incompetence of his department by opting for a self-serving, sanctimonious sermon as opposed to any direct speech. The Secretary of State, who has stood at that dispatch box, I'm going back now a very long way, I seem to recall, avowedly taking exclusive responsibility for the delivery of everything from IT systems to universal credit to taking people out of poverty, when in fact what he has actually done and plunged thousands and thousands of our fellow citizens into the most abject penury, And still he managed today to avoid any kind of reference to the realities of the situation for all those people who, when Atos was had their contract renewed for the work capability assessment many, many months ago. And I can distinctly remember the select committee being really quite forensic in examining Atos as to way they would prioritise, as the government, as the Secretary of State had told us they would do, the needs of disabled and vulnerable people, particularly those with mental health difficulties. And the confirmation was given to us by Atos that, yes, this was going to be an absolute target for them. There would be champions for people with mental health difficulties. There would be detailed individual examination of every single individual who came forward for a work capability assessment. And despite the Harrington changes to which the Secretary of State referred, there have been no marked improvements. We've already heard the figures of people who are waiting for ESA. I will give a precise example of just how chaotic the system is. One of my constituents, paraplegic, placed on ESA. Another constituent, 26 years old, with the mental capacity of a six-year-old, who is consistently having to go for work capability assessments. And I find it absolutely impossible to believe that members sitting opposite have no constituent who comes to them with similar or even worse situations. And yet members opposite find the points that were made by my right honourable friend from the front bench as hilarious. They find it really, really funny that we have seen this explosion in food banks where people who are working, and I would just point out to the Secretary of State that he furnished absolutely no evidence, nor did any member sitting opposite, that the jobs which they are trumpeting that have been created during his sovereignty of the Department of Work and Pensions are actually created by his policies. There are other members of his government who trumpet that these new jobs that are being created by the private sector. One certain thing in an uncertain world is that there are people who are waiting to have their appeals heard. 48%, I'm talking now about ESA. I didn't want anybody to be under any kind of confusion. 48% of appeals are upheld. We are seeing people on ESA who are waiting months before their appeals will be heard, and during that period they are either told to apply for job seekers allowance, which they cannot do because they have been told they are unfit for work, and they are absolutely without any kind of financial support at all. As my honourable friend said, we are looking at a welfare state which was created to protect people from actually falling through the cracks. What this particular Secretary of State, what this particular department is doing, is pushing people through those cracks and hoping that the rest of the country won't notice that they've disappeared.
That's Glenda Jackson, Labour MP, there talking about Ian Duncan-Smith, who remained in place as part of this latest, this week's cabinet reshuffle. Daniela, she's saying there people are actually being, rather than being allowed to fall through the cracks, people are being pushed through the cracks. This is pretty frightening, scary. These are the most vulnerable people in our community.
Yes, all the new systems don't really work. I mean, she's got examples. I've got examples. Someone in my constituency was in a deteriorating state of health and waited over 6 months for an assessment, which meant that he couldn't access other services because you need these sort of assessments so you can get other services like a free bus pass. So it's not even the fact that it's all these huge delays and the system aren't even working properly to give people the money that they're owed when it's completely obvious that they're owed. I mean, Ian Duncan-Smith didn't even turn up to the Local Government Association conference to speak to the delegates about welfare reform. We had a lot of talk about how wonderful universal credit is, but in fact it's actually the whole problem, it's going to be paid online, so a lot of people don't have access capabilities or abilities to access things online. And also what came out after questioning was that the beauty apparently of universal credit is that we'll be able to back up the salary of people on 0 hours contracts. So basically I think it's been actually envisaged as a state subsidy system for the private sector. I mean, most benefits go to people in work, as Glenda Jackson said. These are very, the jobs that are being created are very poorly paid, so people can't manage on the wages that they're being given.
I mean, I loved her. Thought she's really serrated in her attack on, you know, what is essentially a pretty cruel system right now for people that desperately need a bit of help. They can't get it, and they're just being told, "Well, go and sell yourself on the job market." But then, of course, there aren't the jobs.
That's right. And you could say, well, why is IDS still in place? And I think that if they were to remove him, they'd have to admit what a disaster his reign has been. And therefore, they don't want to draw attention to it. On one level, the Conservatives are looking to get votes from what you might call the tight-fisted middle class in the marginal constituencies, and they quite like to hear that people are being given a hard time who are on benefits. But on the other side, the churches then pipe up and say, "But we've got all these people in our food banks," and they don't like to hear that, because of course the church is a rather middle class institution, and there they are saying that this is all wrong. So in a way, they can't win on this one, because they should never have gone down the road in the first place. The idea of persecuting the weakest in the community in order to pay back the debts the banks had run up is clearly wrong. But everybody's forgotten about the banks. Remember them? The banks? The ones that crashed? That's the real cause of all of our troubles.
Well, contradictory news this week about employment. Rising employment fails again to boost wages. So, yes, more people in jobs, but wages down. This is The Guardian on Wednesday. Unemployment fell last month as Britain's economy added jobs at an unprecedented pace, according to official figures, but the recovery failed to lift wages by more than a fraction, leaving workers suffering another real terms cut in living standards. Jobless rate fell to 6.5% of the workforce, while the number of people in work edged higher to a fresh record of 30.6 million. Also, though, according to the TUC, the Trades Union Congress, no region, no nation, nobody escapes. Unemployment rate is actually higher than recession times all over the UK and all over different age groups. This is Tim Lezard writing for the TUC. And what he's saying, employment rates and joblessness are higher today than before the recession in every region and nation of the UK and across all working age groups, suggesting the economy is actually still less healthy than before the recession. Ahead of the publication of the latest jobs figures. So the TUC are basically coming up with a bit of a different story there, Daniella. What do you think the reality is in all this?
I suspect the TUC, I would expect the TUC is much more like the reality than it is, because the government has all these different ways of measuring the job figures that they seem to change every few years, and so they actually get a true handle on it, and the definitions are always very weaselly. You know, if you've had, like, you know, 1 hour's work in the week, you probably count as being employed. So, yeah, I think it's really, and I think that the people that are really suffering are young people, because they're just, the job market hasn't been open. The unemployment didn't initially go up because people did keep on workers on lower salaries and on reduced hours, but that meant there weren't the opportunities opening up for young people. And I think these TUC figures, I'm sure, are true.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably correct. I mean, the fact is that the economy is just a bit bigger than it was before the crash, and we've got more people employed than ever before, because we've had an increase in population partly to do with immigration. But that means that productivity per worker must be lower than it was, and it is. GDP per head is still lower than it was before the crisis. So, in actual fact, the crisis isn't over. Well, everybody talking about this, oh, well, as the economy picks up, what are we going to do with the extra money we're going to get? That's delusionary. It's all based on money printing, and all it will take is another aircraft shot down in the Ukraine or a war in the Middle East, and the whole economy will go straight down the drain. The banks have collapsed in Portugal and Bulgaria. Did you see that on the news yesterday? The banking systems are collapsing in those countries. How much do you think the City of London is exposed to that? Quite a lot.
Well, how about, you mentioned Argentina a few weeks ago. We've heard anything about that. What's happening there?
Well, the Argentinians, the vulture funds managed to get a Supreme Court decision in the US against Argentina, which said they had to pay 100% of the debts which they'd bought for, you know, cents on the dollar. And the Argentinians were refusing. But if they carry on to refuse...
Well, they would probably say it's fraud, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's what they are saying. And they've done a deal with 90-something% of their creditors to pay them at a reasonable rate. state, well, and they had to write down the principal. These vulture funds buy up these debts at pennies, and then they go into the Supreme Court in the US, and the Supreme Court in the US says, oh, they're entitled to 100% of what the piece of paper says, even though they bought it for 3p, it's worth a dollar, except it isn't. And the Argentinians are hanging tough and say, well, they're not just hanging tough, they're saying we can't pay this, but Argentina will go into default at the end of this month. I think they've got 30 days to sort it out. And they go, and if Argentina goes into default, let me remind you what happened when Argentina went into default in 2000. It was the dot-com bubble crash. So Argentina, just on its own, can bring down the entire banking system. Crazy, isn't it?
Okay, back to the employment statistics. And just to let people know, all these statistics, do you know where they come from? Here's a little quiz for today. Just across the river in Newport, the Office of National Statistics is in Newport. And I've spoken to a couple of people over the years who work there, and they assure me that there's tremendous political pressure to come out with the right figures, and that quite often figures are massaged. So, but anyway, at the end of the day, we're facing a situation with more and more people getting paid relatively less and less all the time, Danielle. Have you got to fix the Green Party?
Well, we need to actually have the rich people pay more tax. It's actually, there needs to be redistribution of wealth. We've got the idea of the land value tax, which attacks the 20 or less percent of people, Martin probably knows the figure, people who own all the land in this country should actually be paying for it, because, as we know, there's been rampant asset inflation in this country, leading to the rich getting richer and richer, especially on paper, being able to borrow more money against that. So actually we need to tax that sort of illusionary wealth that's happened because we haven't got a surplus of land in this country, and also higher income tax.
I mean, you saying that, it's just perfectly segues into the next clip, which is another one from Prime Minister's questions. And I'm sorry I couldn't get the name of him, the Scottish MP, because the Speaker was very quiet. But anyway, he's asking David Cameron, why haven't you yet published your tax return, which you promised?
Mr. Speaker, returning to the issue of taxes and the wealthy, when will the Prime Minister keep his promise and publish his tax return?
Well, on the subject of taxes and middle-income people, when are we going to get an answer from Labour about what was it the deputy leader of the party meant when she said, and let me repeat it again for the record, I think people on middle incomes should contribute more through their taxes. There is, as we go into the summer, there is one party in this House with a big tax problem, and I'm looking at it.
Well, at which point I would imagine the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, just say, will the Prime Minister now answer the question, please?
Well, they don't, do they? He gets away with it week in, week out.
Well, what's going on here, surely, is an absolute refusal to come clean about tax. I know you think in Scandinavia, for example, everybody does it. Why not some of the rich here? Do you think it's simply because that they are embarrassed that what they're doing is simply not paying their fair share?
Well, as I've said before, in Norway, everybody's tax returns are public property. Everybody's, not just the Prime Minister's. And it does make a difference when everybody sees how much money some people have got. And it means that, in general, taxes are higher. In this country, there's a definite section of society that really believes that that they shouldn't have to pay any taxes at all.
I'm going to float the boat out now, because I wonder, what do you two think you would find if you opened up David Cameron's tax return? Because his father was actually a pioneer of tax havens. Mm-hmm. When Margaret Thatcher brought down exchange controls, he was one of the first people to offer these offshore places to keep your wealth where it wasn't going to be taxed out of the country. So I'll start with you, Daniela. What would you think you'd see if you opened David Cameron's tax return?
I'd see something that looked fairly innocent, because I'm sure he's found a way of transferring all his assets to his wife and putting them overseas in a bank.
Yes, more than likely, but at the same time I think it would also be quite clear that he, like many other members of the cabinet, are multimillionaires. They're just in politics as a hobby. So for example, if they are evicted at the next election, they will go on to make millions, as Tony Blair has done. And I'm afraid that's how they live in a totally different universe from the ordinary folk.
Be interesting to see what's happened year on year, because you'll probably find through this so-called recession, people like David Cameron have actually been making a mint.
That's right. The people at the top have actually done very well through the asset value increases that Daniela was mentioning. Quantitative easing has been fantastic for those who own assets.
It's also maintained share prices, which the rich generally own. OK, there are pension funds as well to take into account, but the share price has.
Well, I mean, why didn't we think of this years ago, Daniela? We've just got to print money, and that massively increases asset values and share values. Why weren't we doing that for years and years and years? If it's such a brilliant policy, why aren't the Germans so opposed to it, and they don't want to do it? But we've done it, and we've made ourselves very wealthy. Yeah. I'll tell you why, because ultimately that's going to lead to a crash, a big heavy duty.
Well, we know
and the
also
banks
that
are still, you know, joined up. We don't have a separation of retail investment banking that was promised.
We also know that George Ferguson will be in here next week, we hope, where we will ask him about his tax return, because he's a multimillionaire. Have you seen his tax return, Danielle?
I haven't looked for it. I haven't asked him, but I could do. I know he gets all his salary in Bristol pounds from the council.
Well, he probably doesn't need it in real money. Martin?
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember asking him during the election campaign how much he was actually worth and pointing out that in Norway we would know. Yeah. And he just said, I'm a millionaire, it's true, but most of it's tied up in property and I do lots for the community. So pretty much like David Cameron, the answer was, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
Okay, another momentous event this week. The Church of England General Synod has voted yes, finally, to women bishops. There was immediate political support for the vote, which was welcomed by all three party leaders. It annoys me a little bit that there's political support for the church, because I like to think that the church is a bit of a counter to the political world. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because historically, the Church of England, the Catholic Church, have always been a bit of a kind of conflict zone, haven't they, with what politicians and kings seem to want to do. And it looks like they're sort of getting a bit closer now as the equality stuff that's going from what is mainly the political agenda now into the church as well. So do you think that's a good thing, a bad thing?
Well,
how's it going to change
let's just correct you. The Church of England is the established Church of England, unlike the Catholic Church or the Protestant denominations or whatever. So in a sense, politicians...
It's not independent of politics at all.
No, it's not. No. The bishops sit in the House of Lords as Lords Spiritual. I mean, obviously, I welcome this. It's taken long enough. My mother was one of the first women priests some, you know, 20 years ago. But I, personally, I'd be in favour of disestablishing the Church of England so that it could actually take a more prophetic role in criticising government policy over things like food banks.
Yeah, I think it's completely outrageous that we have bishops in the House of Lords. What right do they have over other religions? I think there should be complete disestablishment between church and state. I mean, I'm even really actually against the role of church and religious bodies in education in this country. I think the French have got it right when they have secular education.
Very difficult to be against it, though, because the church was the first to set up schools in Britain. You know, it was but they also played a role in actually persuading parents to give up their kids. You know, it's okay, we're going to educate them in morals and that sort of thing. And I don't know if the same would happen today if children weren't being educated, you know, which is why it was a couple of hundred years ago. People just picked up stuff from those around them. Once there was a formal education system, it seems to me it was important to have a kind of moral one in order to persuade parents to give their children up. Do you think that's just a completely bonkers point of view?
Old-fashioned, I think, yeah.
Well, it's just historically inaccurate. I mean, the primary education was brought in, I think it was in the 1880s, and the school of the churches insisted that they should have control of it. There was no reason for them to have control. There was a big fight in France in the early part of the 20th century to get the Catholic Church out of state schools. And, of course, we've now got all of this confected row going on in Birmingham about the influence of Islam on schools. In my view, schools should be not... No school funded by the government should have any particular religious affiliation.
Okay, another story related. The Archbishop of Canterbury this week has been forced to resign from the Pall Mall Club that refuses to admit women. How interesting. And it's only because after this vote he was saying how wonderful he thought it was that women were now bishops that he was a little bit red-faced when it was announced that he was part of a club that didn't admit women. And Daniela, this equality issue, it sounds like it's all just guff coming from the Archbishop of Canterbury when he's part of this club all the time.
Well, at least he's resigned from it, but I'm absolutely horrified the fact that he was a member in the first place.
Would he have resigned if no one had pointed it out?
I mean, these clubs are completely antediluvian, you know, full of dinosaurs, and they actually, I don't think they should exist. I don't know what exemption they have from equality legislation, but you know, these are places where deals get done, power is there, men can chat about football, smoke pipes and make decisions and influence each other, and you're excluding 51% of the population from these places. I mean, I'm sure women wouldn't even want to be in that sort of environment, but that's more and more reason to say they shouldn't actually be admitted as equal members if they want to.
I wonder, this is my strange way of looking at these things, but I wonder if everyone can smoke in these places too. There's any,
probably.
You know, it's like there is no law in here, just do what you want, guys and girls, and no women. Martin.
Well, it says they're banned from the smoking room and cocktail bar.
Oh, there is a smoking room.
Which refers to members and their male guests.
Well, I mean, the British establishment is the British establishment. It's been there for a very long time, and it operates in a certain kind of
way. Outside the law?
They make the law, don't they? And if they want to be outside it, then they are outside it. There's going to be plenty of... we're going to find out a lot more.
How do these gentlemen's clubs fit into politics? Because that's what we want to know. Mm. It's no good if you're sitting around with your mates around the fire having a pint and deciding on what the next law's going to be, is it?
Well, it's a bit like Freemasonry, Tony. I mean, people who are in these clubs should have to definitely say that they're in them, and there should be no secrecy about it, and they should have to admit it as an interest. Mm.
But the issue is also that people select people to be in these clubs that are like themselves. They never give the opportunity to women to join in because they like to see people in their own image promoted into their own systems of power.
Yeah, okay. Finally, Martin, do you think that the days of the gentlemen's club are still, do you think they're still as powerful as they obviously used to be in years gone by?
Well, obviously, over time, there's been some erosion of their power, but the fact that most of the cabinets are privately educated and most of them went to Eton, if you'd said that 50 years ago, people would have laughed at you. They would have said, oh, but Britain will have changed a lot more than that. But it hasn't. It's still run by the same people it's always been run by.
I must admit, I'd agree with you, because certainly in media circles, there are a couple of media club-based clubs up in London. If you want to get yourself a nice series from the BBC or Channel 4, that's where the deals are done.
Yeah.
Anyway, on to the next story. Generation Rent strikes back with a new TripAdvisor for tenants site. And we've been talking quite a lot about housing on here over the last few weeks. Landlords, be warned. Generation Rent is about to get its revenge. A national website allowing tenants to review rental properties in which they have stayed has been launched with the aim of becoming a TripAdvisor of the rental market. The website is rentalraters.com. Daniella.
Great idea. I mean, renters are in a terrible position. I know Rob Telford's got a motion to council about, or things to council about, the new housing association in Easton trying to challenge sort of the rented sector and the terrible conditions they're in. I mean, I think there should be some kind of new right to rent and actually more tenancy rights given to renters, because more than half the population now are having to rent their houses. They can't afford to buy them, so it's a growing population. They're at the mercy of landlords providing poor conditions and extortionate rents.
And also that, of course, massively increases the housing benefit bill, subsidising people in work. So they're in work, their rent is so great that the government has to pay. And that money just goes straight into the pockets of the people who then vote for the government because they own the houses.
OK, well, thanks very much to this week's guest, the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Bishopston, Daniella Radici. After the Murdoch News, more of everything Britain's mainstream media is keeping from you. Losing one Malaysia airline is one thing, but two might be carelessness.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the US President says a missile fired from rebel-held territory in Ukraine downed a Malaysian passenger jet, killing 298 people.
Their deaths are an outrage of unspeakable proportions.
Barack Obama says it's a wake-up call to the world about the situation in the region. Rebels deny they're to blame, as do the Ukrainian authorities. Around 200 bodies have been recovered at the scene. Our reporter Stuart Ramsey is there.
This is one of the main sections. It's the rear section of the plane, but it's also part of the fuselage a little way beyond. There's a very, very strong smell of jet fuel. Bodies were found here as well, around the fuselage.
10 of the victims are British. They include two football fans going to watch Newcastle.